It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickert, will be back with me on Tuesday. Coming up later, we'll look at the debate over bending admissions rules for athletes at the nation's colleges and universities. First, the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas ends today. It's a place for companies to show off their latest high-tech developments. A lot of those aren't on the market yet, might not be for some years to come. Walking around the show is like a step into the future with robots, wearable technology, smart everything. And this year, self-driving cars. And these cars are stealing the show, I guess, with Mercedes-Benz in particular, featuring a car in which passengers face each other while the car itself manages the road. Here with us to talk about this new technology is David Underkoffler, auto writer for the LA Times. David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, when I think of big new high-tech car stuff, I usually think, you know, the Detroit Auto Show and those other big ones. Do automakers usually make such a big splash at this Consumer Electronics Show?
Well, it's been growing over the past number of years, and I think this is a good place for them to really sort of focus everything, all their efforts on technology. You know, maybe without the distraction of other automakers or other products, you know, at the Detroit Auto Show, maybe it's just sort of your mainstream vehicles that you can buy in the next year or so. CES is really turning into a sort of a dream world of, okay, here's what's going to be coming in the farther future, maybe in the 10 or 15-year range.
So we've got prototypes, we've got some self-driving cars being tested. How do these things work?
Well, they're pretty complicated. They're using a number of different systems. I would say there are, you know, 360 degree radar systems. There are stereoscopic cameras, so, you know, cameras that are looking in front of the car and behind the car. Some automakers are using laser systems to sort of create a real-time 3D map of what's going on around the car, and then the computers are reacting to that in real time. Other cars are using infrared sensors. So it's really, you know, it's sort of a combination of a number of different sensors because you want to sort of see what's going on, you know, in a couple different layers around the car. So what's going on right in front of it, and then what's going on maybe 100 yards in front of it, and then maybe a quarter mile in front of it, so the car can prepare and react to all of those different situations.
A gut reaction is, I think, from your average driver, is this safe?
It will be. I mean, keep in mind, a vast majority of car accidents, and especially traffic fatalities, are all due to human error. And when you take that human error out of the equation, all of the experts and analysts you speak to say this is going to have really, you know, encouraging, you know, positive implications for safety. You know, traffic fatalities are expected to fall, you know, sort of as these technologies become, you know, more common on the road.
Now, you wrote about, and we mentioned, the Mercedes-Benz car. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is kind of cool. Basically, Mercedes said, let's reinvent the car. Let's imagine all of the regulatory hurdles and all the policy hurdles that are sort of all the automakers are facing right now. Let's imagine those were not there anymore, and we're building a car from the ground up in say, 2030. What will a Mercedes look like at that time? And so this is a car where, you know, there is a steering wheel, but it's really not, you know, the primary function of that car. Like, as you mentioned, the four occupants sit facing one another, and it's a sort of lounge space. There's these, you know, touch screens throughout the car that you can use for, you know, entertainment and movies and the internet. And they're positioning it really sort of as this is going to be what luxury is once you don't no longer need to drive. Luxury will be time spent. They call it a mobile living space, and it's really sort of how automobiles, especially luxury automobiles, will really evolve over the next 15, 20 years.
I understand Audi has actually had some of these cars. They've gotten permits to have them on real live roads. What have they done? How has that worked out?
Yeah, currently only four states allow testing of autonomous vehicles on the roads, and Nevada and California are two of those. So Audi thought, well, this is a good chance to sort of, A, get some testing done, and sure, why not? Let's get a little PR at the same time. So they drove a car. They had some journalists get licensed to drive these cars or sort of sit in them as they're being driven, and drove them from Silicon Valley to Nevada. And there's this long sort of caravan of support vehicles, and it was very sort of carefully orchestrated, but it was these cars were on the freeways were driving autonomously. The laws right now require a licensed, capable driver to be sitting in the driver's seat, ready to go in case anything goes wrong, and sort of assume control of the car And also they had an Audi technician sitting in the passenger seat. But this was, you know, sort of a first step. Audi was the first automaker in the state of California to get a permit to do that. So I think they saw a chance to capitalize on that.
Now, you mentioned the Mercedes was thinking along the lines of, this is the car maybe of 2030. Audi has these cars being tested on the road now. Is there a timeline in mind where we might actually see a consumer buying one of these things and getting to work in one?
Well, yes and no. I mean, a lot of luxury cars really sort of have the fundamentals of this technology in them already. I mean, you can get a car, you know, a luxury car today that will have radar-based cruise control, so it stays a set distance behind the car in front of you. It'll keep you in your lane. It will apply the brakes automatically if it knows you're about to hit something and you have not hit the brakes yourself. So really, we're just sort of going to build on those. You know, brands like Mercedes, Audi, Infiniti, which is owned by Nissan, are sort of pointing, and Cadillac too, are pointing to, you know, maybe 2020 is when you'd start seeing really, it'll be an expensive option on their highest end car. It won't be until maybe 2025, 2030 before you're seeing this as more of a mainstream, you know, option. You know, and then maybe beyond that, you'll see fully autonomous cars, you know, sort of be much more common. So it's in the near term, we're going to see it on a very limited basis, but it is inevitable. I mean, this is not a question of if, it's a question of when.
Well, like a lot of things in automotive history, I guess the laws, state, federal, local even, will have to catch up with this technology.
They do, and that's sort of one of like I said, it's one of the bigger hurdles. The laws are really sort of antiquated, not only in terms of allowing these vehicles to be tested on public roads, because automakers, you know, they're right now they're sort of forced to create these fake cities on private grounds to test autonomous vehicles. But it's also a matter of data security. You know, these cars gather so much data on board, and how do you, the automakers are really sort of behind the eight ball in determining how do you make that data safe? How do you make it, you know, how do you prevent someone from hacking into these cars, either to steal the data or to take control of the cars? You know, the experts I spoke to said, you know, they're optimistic that, you know, both data security and the policy will sort of catch up. But right now, it really, you know, like I said, the laws really do have a lot of sort of ground to make up.
Now, self-driving cars have been the big automotive story at the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas. I guess there's been some news about hydrogen fuel cell technology. I don't know if that's going on at the show, but some companies starting to share their patents with their rival companies. Where are we on hydrogen cell powered cars?
You know, that's another thing that actually I think is going to probably happen fairly quickly, or maybe quicker than most people might expect. You know, automakers like them because they don't have that sort of built-in range anxiety that I think some people may have about a purely electric car. And whether that's rational or not, it is sort of been known to prevent people from buying an electric car. So hydrogen fuel, you have just water vapor is the only emission out of these vehicles. So that's very attractive from an automaker who, by federal standards, they need to keep their cars very efficient in terms of emission and miles per gallon. So Toyota is one of the leading automakers. They spent 20 years developing this technology. And at CES, they announced that they were going to open up their patents to competitors. You know, one guy I spoke to, one expert was saying, you know, it's not an issue of patents. It's not like they're giving away the farm here. Really what Toyota wants to do, you know, they're going to be the first to bring one of these cars to market this year. It's already on sale in Japan. Will go on sale in the U.S. in October. It is in Toyota's best interest to really get this industry off the ground and make sure that you have infrastructure, so you have fueling stations and things like that, and that they're not the only one making this car, because, you know, it's sort of going to limit the audience for it. So I think this is just sort of them saying, hey, we're all in. We would like, you know, anyone else who wants to join us in this. This is sort of mutually beneficial if we can sort of advance this technology and get it on the road pretty quick.
David, is this an exciting time to be an automotive journalist?
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of really cool tech coming out and a lot of cool developments, and you know, cars are getting, you know, faster and safer at the same time and more efficient. And I think, you know, I would definitely, you know, say stay tuned to the Detroit show, because from what we've heard, there's going to be a lot of cool stuff coming out of that. So, yeah, it's never dull. There's always new stuff around the corner.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
We've been speaking with David Underkoffler, auto writer for the LA Times. The Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas ends today. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. After an exciting win over Auburn in the Outback Bowl and the hiring of a new head coach, might seem that all's well in Badger football land, but is it? When previous head coach Gary Anderson surprisingly left the team after a couple years on the job, rumors began to surface that he was frustrated with UW's difficult admission standards for incoming college freshmen and was maybe missing out on big recruits because of that. While we might not completely know what led to Anderson's departure, those rumors do raise some interesting questions as to how and when universities loosen their admission standards to admit athletes who might not qualify otherwise. Joining us now to discuss these questions is Welch Suggs. He's an associate professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. He's a former sports journalist and was the senior editor for athletics at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Welch, thanks for joining us again.
No, happy to do it, Ron. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start by looking at the college admissions process. We know grades, a big part of determining eligibility. What else can go into a decision, though?
Well, Rob, it all depends on what kind of college you're talking about, but mostly in terms of big-time college sports, we're talking about fairly selective universities, such as those in the Big Ten or the SEC. And schools typically manage their admissions process in a pretty simple way. There are some people who are going to be brilliant, some students who have great grades, great SAT scores, as you suggested, and they're going to get in automatically, or there are some who are simply not going to be competitive academically and are sort of cut off at the bottom end. And then there's a great middle pool where some people are going to get in and some people aren't. And of that group, you know, there are many, many factors that can play a role. It might be where you're from, if you're from an underserved area that the university would like to get more people from. It might be if you're a member of a racial or ethnic minority group. It might be if you're a legacy, you know, if you're someone in your family went to that school. All of these factors can play in. Sometimes even children of politicians, if you're talking about large state universities, can be a factor. And, of course, athletics is another one of those.
So how much leeway do different universities, different big programs have when it comes to bringing in athletes in particular who don't meet the standards that might be there for other students?
Sure. Well, it depends on the school, and different schools have different standards and all that. The NCAA does have its own set of academic requirements, but they're really pretty minimal. They're things that just about anybody can get, and they're certainly not at the level of students who are trying to get into the University of Wisconsin or the University of Georgia or places like that. So it's up to schools really to decide where to set those bars, and that's the really hard issue to tackle. You know, the NCAA and its members all say they want athletes to be student athletes and to be fully engaged with the academic experience. But when you look back through history, going all the way back to the late 19th century even, colleges and universities have always recruited athletes who weren't capable of or weren't interested in the student part of the deal. And that's what led the NCAA to start imposing academic requirements, starting with Prop 48, which some of your older listeners may remember back in the 1980s. And it's what led Cardale Jones to tweet about not going to Ohio State to play school a few months ago. But there's a sliding scale for grades and test scores under the current rules, and but as I said, they're far lower than what it would take to get into universities like Madison or UGA. So the question is, where are you going to draw the line? Where are you going to say we'll recruit these folks and not these other folks? And this can be a very political issue, but it's something that coaches face at every school at every level, whether you're talking about Harvard or Wisconsin or wherever it might happen to be.
Well, let's look at this from the side of the athlete who maybe got in, the admissions were bent a little in their favor. Are they coming out of colleges, out of universities with degrees, employable prospects, assuming that they're not one of the small percentage that goes into professional sports?
Sure. Well, you got to remember that when we're talking across athletics, most of the time people are doing the right things and kids are graduating and getting on moving degrees. But there are flags that come up. Like, I did happen to look at graduation rates for Wisconsin-Madison, and the latest stats show that Wisconsin had about 83% of all undergraduates finish their degrees in 6 years, but only about 71% of athletes did, and only about 50% of football players did. So you are seeing some kind of disparity here where you have these two pools of, you know, where you're recruiting students from one pool and athletes from another pool. And it can be tough if you think about it from the athlete side as well. It can be a difficult experience because students can sometimes resent athletes for getting what they perceive to be a free ride with a lot of perks. And athletes can be isolated and stereotyped on campus. I had one student who was a prominent football player on our team in class this past year, wrote a very moving essay about how hard it was to be so obvious walking into class. And he actually was late on the first day and felt like everyone's eyes were on him for the rest of the semester because he was singled out. So it can be a very isolating experience. And then academically, a lot of athletes are coming from poor high school backgrounds, so you have this question about whether they're going to be able to keep up in the classroom with all the other students. And at an elite academic university, the question is going to be, for folks who don't have such a strong high school background, what are they going to study and what majors are they going to be able to get done given the demands of their sports? And then the question, as you suggested, is are they in degree programs that will help them get good jobs and provide for their careers outside athletics? And most of the time, schools do a good job and athletes do a good job, and being at a school like Wisconsin can open a lot of doors. But there are plenty of cases where, especially in the revenue sports, is what we're talking about, football and men's basketball, where you have this question about whether athletes are getting the same quality of experience as other students.
I think a lot of this points toward a fundamental question about athletics and higher education. Do they, are athletics kind of, especially the big sports, the football and men's basketball, are they the tail wagging the dog, interfering with the academic mission, or are they in ways a complement for each other? How do you sort that out?
Well, some schools do a great job of balancing this. You know, Stanford is one example where they recruit an awful lot of very good athletes who are capable of taking advantage and contributing to the Stanford student experience. I spent some time out there a while back now, but you could see how schools, especially if they're very selective, have the opportunity to recruit a very well-rounded student body. So people bring different things to the table and can contribute in very good ways. But a lot of other people, and certainly a lot of professors, do see these two roles of sort of the commercial business of athletics and the academic business of the university as being in conflict, because athletes are there and their experiences are largely shaped by their coaches and by their athletic experience. So it's always a balancing act, and I don't have any information about what's happened at Madison or with Coach Anderson or whatever issues he might have faced there. But schools always try to manage this tension between academics and athletics, and sometimes they do a very good job of it, and sometimes they do a very poor job of it.
Is there pressure, maybe especially from alumni who are counted on for big donations and may want successful football and men's basketball programs and are saying, hey, guys, do what you got to do to bring in the star athletes?
Oh, sure. There's always stuff like that going on. The question is whether the academic leaders of the university have the authority and the power, frankly, to deal with those kinds of issues. You know, we had a guy down here in Georgia running for in our congressional district, say dismissively that he wouldn't mind if they got rid of the entire state of Georgia or the entire University of Georgia as long as they kept the football team. And there are plenty of people who see that and see winning at all costs as being, feature of, or you know, being their main priority for their alma mater. But at the same time, there are plenty of other people who do recognize the value of education and recognize that sports has its place and that you've got to find the right line to walk in terms of admitting people who can do what's expected of them, both in the classroom and on the field. So, again, you know, I wish I could give you specifics, but you know, there's always a spectrum with these things with universities. And that's what makes it so difficult in a lot of the conversations right now about whether athletes ought to get paid or whether they should be considered as, you know, legally different from other students. You know, some people believe very strongly that they should be, amateurs, and that's an important component of American higher education. But other people would just rather see winning teams and exciting games.
Now, some schools have either eliminated things like football teams or are considering that, maybe partly because the revenue isn't coming in, maybe partly because of issues like we're talking about now. Do you think we'll see more maybe mid-level schools doing that sort of thing?
We can. I mean, that's, again, a more difficult and I think often less philosophical question when you see a situation like the University of Alabama at Birmingham, which recently dropped football, because on their grounds they just couldn't afford it and they could not create a competitive program where they were in a state like Alabama where football is religion. And I'm sure the same is true to a certain degree in Wisconsin as well, but down south we do football on a slightly different, higher level, not higher level, but just a different level of intensity. But anyway, there are certainly schools that have decided that sports like football were not worth the trade-offs it took academically. This is probably 15 years or so ago, but Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania basically decided that they were having to make too many exceptions to their admissions policies to get in football players, and so they dropped that team. But you got to remember, Swarthmore is a tiny liberal arts college. It's about the size of Beloit or a little bit smaller, and has very, 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 very high standards. So I don't think that you're going to see many cases of that. I mean, if that were seriously an issue, then you probably would have seen football die out at the Ivy League schools, and yet they still all have football teams, and they compete at the football championship subdivision level. But it's a very difficult thing to manage. It's always been a difficult thing to manage. Back in the 40s, the University of Chicago dropped their entire athletic program because they thought it was antithetical to higher education.
We're talking with Welch Suggs of the University of Georgia about college admissions, academics, and athletics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much should colleges be able to bend the rules on admissions to admit athletes, especially for the high-profile sports? If you are an athlete yourself, share your experience as well. Call in 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation after the news. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard will be back with me on Tuesday. We're talking now with Welch Suggs of the University of Georgia about college admissions, academics, and athletics. Close to home, former Wisconsin Badgers head coach Gary Anderson is rumored to have left his job in part because the UW wouldn't budge on loosening tight admission standards, thus maybe losing out on possible recruits. We want to know what you think about this at 800-642-1234. How flexible or inflexible do you think colleges should be with incoming athletes? Should athletics be an important part of the university experience? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Should universities let in the star athletes, even though they might not meet the academic standards coming in? Again, 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Welch, you mentioned that universities and colleges have their admission standards and the rules for how they apply to athletes, and that the NCAA has their standards. Does the NCAA actively police this sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely. Academic eligibility issues are one of the main functions, frankly, of the NCAA day in and day out. So what you see is if you are a prospective athlete, then you actually have to register with the NCAA clearinghouse, and they have to verify your eligibility for you to be able to complete or to compete. So often you see cases where athletes are delayed from being able to get out there and practice or play for their teams because their eligibility is still being verified. And there are all sorts of ways to cheat the system. My former colleague Brad Wolverton at the Chronicle of Higher Education had a great piece that ran both in the Chronicle and Sports Illustrated about fixers and who can help athletes get the grades they need to get into college. So it raises an awful lot of ethical issues, but it's part of the game, frankly, these days in college sports.
Is this a case where just the sheer amount of money involved in these high-profile sports, again, the football and the men's basketball, creates temptations to some kinds of rule-bending or creative solutions to enforcement?
It is, but I think it gets beyond just the pure dollars and cents to more about a university's image or its place in the pecking order, its prestige. You know, a lot of universities will use sports to try to get themselves into the same conversation with much more elite schools. We had a college president tell me that he had moved his athletic department into Division I so that they could get on the ticker on ESPN. And his line was that, you know, we're in the same league academically with Duke and Davidson. This is a school in North Carolina. and we want to be in their league athletically too. So he thought that by getting on the ticker, so their scores would come up next to Duke's and Davidson's and so forth, that gave them an air of legitimacy. And, you know, I'm sure this is true in Madison. It's certainly true at Georgia and Michigan and Ohio State and other places I've been. You know, sports and big-time sports are such a huge part of the college culture, the college experience. And to be, it's imperative for schools like this to be competitive in football and occasionally in men's basketball, depending on where you're at. And other hot sports, too, like hockey, I'm sure, up where you are and things like that. And so schools, there simply aren't enough elite athletes to go around who can meet the admission standards of a place like Michigan or Wisconsin or Georgia, for that matter. So schools are kind of forced to bend the rules, if you want to put it that way, or to admit athletes who wouldn't otherwise be getting in to be competitive.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Joe on the line in Portage. Hi, Joe.
Hey, I have experience with UW Madison, and it seems to me that a lot of the, I don't know, specifically football or basketball or the sports that would be typically filled with jocks, they just can't keep up with the academics, and it seems like it kind of gets in the minds of the kids, the smart kids, or the kids who try hard, and they see them, you know, during class cheating or not doing what they have to, but they're getting by with just because of their scholarship.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Welch, you mentioned earlier maybe a stigma from non-athletes toward these athletes. Do we know, I mean, are the athletes more prone to cheating or sliding through without doing much work, or is that a perception issue?
Yeah, I don't think things like that are widespread. I mean, even at a place where the standards are just going to be very divergent between athletes who come in and students who come in, I can tell you there is a lot of resentment that I hear periodically from time to time, even on a campus like this where athletes are very much lionized. But you've got to think about how hard it is for the kids who are in that position of being scholarship athletes. You know, often they'll have study hall or workouts or something first thing in the morning, and then they'll go straight to class and be in class and have to go to practice and then have to deal with team meetings and training room and this like this and that, and then study a little bit and go to bed and get back and do it all over again. So it really is like having a couple of full-time jobs on top of your academic load. So it is very stressful, and as I noted, a lot of them don't have the academic background necessarily to be competitive. So there are some people who believe, like I guess Cardale Jones must have at Ohio State, that you know school just wasn't that important compared to football. But the vast majority of athletes that I've taught or interviewed or come into contact with really are there to try to make the most out of their experience and to figure out where to go, both in their sports and when sports are over. So I think academic dishonesty and entitlement, stuff like that, there's certainly issues, but they're issues for a very few out of the vast number of, you know, half a million or so athletes in college right now.
Joe, thanks for that call. We'll go to John in Madison now. John, hi.
Hi. I attended the University of Wisconsin at Madison. My son is a graduate. My daughter-in-law is a graduate. And I think that the University of Wisconsin has its priorities right and are able to compete at the level of the Big Ten. And they do a pretty good job of it, especially when you look across the whole board of the athletic program. They have one of the best programs in the country. So I think they have the priorities right, and I'm proud to be a part of, or related at least, to that system and part of Wisconsin that is represented by this great institution.
John, thanks a lot for that call. He's endorsing UW-Madison's approach. Welch, do you think that a lot of schools, for the most part, are getting it right?
I think so, for the most part. I mean, when you think about Madison, you know, obviously they weren't there, or the football team wasn't that far from getting into the championship playoff, the finals of which are going to be Monday. So I think that by and large they do, but there are certainly plenty of cases on any campus that you want to point to where athletes are not getting a fair shake one way or another. It may not be their fault. It may not be their fault. But there's always going to be that tension, whatever campus you happen to be on, between the athletic priorities or the commercial priorities of the athletic department and the academic priorities of the university. and some places can mostly keep that balance. They can walk that line, but every year there's going to be some kind of challenge.
John, thanks for the call. We'll go to Greg in Waukesha now. Greg, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question about why wouldn't student athletes just be classified as employees of the university, student workers, and participate in sports, but they're doing that primarily or purely for money for the university and entertainment. So why not call it that, but let them be employees, let them be student workers, and let them be admitted solely upon their academic standing, and yet, if they happen to be good athletes, let them participate as a student worker in extracurriculars. That's really what it is. It's a job.
Greg, thanks a lot for the call. There's been a lot of talk, and you alluded to this earlier, Welch, about the idea of some student athletes being paid for playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is actually the subject of a couple of major lawsuits that are going on right now about whether athletes, college athletes, have commercial rights or rights to some of the money, the billions of dollars that flows in through broadcast contracts and payoffs from bowl games and this, that, and the other in athletic programs. And I guess there's an idealistic answer and a cynical answer to that. And the idealistic answer is that the schools have done this form of amateur sports, with athletes who are not paid but do get scholarships, now for about 110 years in round numbers. This has always been the premise of college sports, is that athletes are treated as amateurs, treated as students, and not as professionals there to play a game. And the NCAA would make that call and say this is a great and noble thing, that they're learning special lessons and getting a special experience in college, et cetera, et cetera. The more cynical answer is that it's a money grab by the schools, and they benefit tremendously from having an unpaid labor force. And so the NCAA and all of its member institutions have fought tooth and nail to prevent any move towards getting athletes classified as employees because of all of the money that would cost and all of the headaches that that would engender. You know, you think about paying people, you think about being subject to workers' comp claims, which may yet happen with the concussion epidemic and things like that. So it could happen. You know, it probably would be a more honest way of doing business. But the only way it's going to happen is if the courts find athletes to be employees and entitled to compensation under the wage laws. And sometimes I pretend to be a lawyer, but I'm certainly not a good enough one to predict how that's going to come out.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining us and talking about these fairly complicated issues.
Absolutely. Happy to do it, Rob.
That's Welch Suggs. He's an associate professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. He's also a former sports journalist and was the senior editor for athletics at the Chronicle of Higher Education. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for a weekly look at what's happening this week in Wisconsin news. Today, a big week in state politics. Governor Walker was sworn in for his second term, has plans ahead that look a bit like the plans of somebody maybe priming the pump for a presidential bid. Also, the Assembly released its school accountability bill. That's getting a lot of attention. One person paying attention, Noah Ovshinsky. He joins us each week to catch us up on Wisconsin news. Noah, welcome back.
It's good to be here, and happy Friday, Rob.
Happy Friday to you as well. Well, it was a big day for Governor Walker. Re-inaugurated, term two kicks off.
Yeah, exactly. He delivered his second inauguration speech on Monday. And I have to say, his speech struck a similar tone to the one he gave on election night, right after basically his acceptance speech. And in a sense, he contrasted what he was doing in Wisconsin to what he sees happening in Washington, D.C. Here's a bit of the sound from the inauguration speech.
There is a clear contrast between Washington and Wisconsin. We have been good stewards of the taxpayers' money and lowered their tax burden as well. We've shown why the founders of this great nation looked to the states and not the federal government as the source of hope for this exceptional country. We will not let them down.
So, you know, Congress, record low approval ratings again and again in the last couple of years. So what do you make of this contrast?
Yeah, I mean, I think this contrast between Washington and D.C. could be a compelling message to certain voters, especially primary voters. And, you know, as you sort of alluded to, you know, with the governor exploring a run for president, I think it's a message he feels like he needs to, you know, get out there.
So that contrast between Wisconsin and the nation's capital, a big theme. What else do we hear from the governor?
Yeah, so beyond that contrast, the governor also talked about freedom. In fact, I think it was one of the really major themes that he brought up during the speech. Here again is the governor talking about freedom, the other big theme.
In Wisconsin, we understand that true freedom and prosperity do not come from the mighty hand of the government. They come from empowering people to control their own lives and their own destinies through the dignity that is born from work.
So again, he's talking to Wisconsin here, but is he pitching this to a wider audience?
Absolutely. You know, this idea of freedom, especially in the context of, you know, the size of government or its role in people's lives, it, you know, again, it's a compelling message and one that comes up a lot, especially for somebody who has national ambitions, somebody who's looking to maybe gain traction with primary voters, conservative primary voters, looking toward a possible presidential run.
Now, this could have been a laundry list of things he'd like to see passed this year with a Republican legislature. Do we get any specific policy notions out of this speech?
Yeah, a few. He talked a bit about a few things, and we've obviously talked about it for the last several weeks as the news has come out about them. But the governor talked about reducing the size and scope of government. Of course, he's talked about shrinking certain agencies and combining certain agencies here in the state. His desire to prioritize funding for roads. Again, this debate over how we're going to pay for infrastructure is ongoing and will certainly, I think, probably at some point come to a head here in the coming weeks as he presents his budget. And he also alluded to his desire to expand the state's voucher school program, which, again, is something that he's talked a lot about and one that will most likely come up here in the coming weeks.
Now, there's been some attention on the governor's travel plans this week.
Yeah, talking about possible presidential ambitions, the governor plans to attend an event in Iowa geared towards conservatives called the Freedom Summit. And not coincidentally, he will be joining other presidential hopefuls, including Governor Chris Christie, Senator Ted Cruz, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, and others.
So why is he going? Why is he joining this list of rumored potential presidential candidates?
Well, the Iowa caucuses are a year-ish away. So I think, you know, this will be one of the multiple trips to Iowa I think the governor will likely take in 2015. So I think this is the start, I think. This is just the beginning.
And I've heard from some political observers on this show that Iowa, for early primary states, that's as close as Governor Walker gets to home field advantage. So
yeah,
it makes sense for him to put some time in there.
And he's been there a few times, if not several times, in the last few years. So, I mean, I think this is just the beginning again of he'll be logging a lot of miles between Madison and Iowa.
No, I spent a weekend in Dubuque a few years ago, and I got like no media attention, not even from my colleagues here at WPR. I'm a little hurt, frankly.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, I'm probably never going to run for president. That would just go. So anyway, we don't need to open that door, people. Well, looking ahead now, this inauguration speech isn't always the laundry list policy thing, but the governor has a couple events coming up that tend to be more policy focused.
Yeah, his State of the State address is coming up next week. And the governor also said this week that he plans to release his budget on February 3rd, which, if you keep track of these kinds of things by historical standards, is quite early. And I think it's a testament to how quickly he wants to get this budget process wrapped up, certainly by the beginning of summer.
And as we say from time to time here when we talk, the budget's the big deal. I mean, so much of what happens in state policy comes down to this budget document.
Absolutely. And basically, it's a testament to what his priorities are, what the priorities of his administration are. And I think, again, you know, all of this will be taken in a national context. Everything that happens in the legislature from now until when this budget is signed, that has national implications for the governor if indeed he's looking to run for president.
Now, state lawmakers are waiting for this budget. That is the big deal they'll have to deal with. But they're not just twiddling their thumbs waiting for that. A school accountability bills, different options are starting to come out now.
Right. So the Assembly Republicans unveiled their school accountability bill this week. And I think it was first, basically the first piece of legislation to drop this session. Now, this issue of school accountability has been controversial in recent years, so I think a lot of people were waiting to see what this bill was actually going to look like.
So what are the fundamentals that people have been looking for in this kind of legislation?
So at its most basic level, it's going to create a letter grade system for schools, A through F. And where it gets interesting, though, is what happens to schools who repeatedly don't measure up, who basically fail.
So, yeah, what happens in at least this early incarnation of this bill to those schools?
And yes, let's emphasize it. This is this is an early incarnation. But as the bill, as it stands now, it depends. For traditional public schools, it requires schools that receive a D or F for 3 years to come up with a plan to fix things. And if after 4 years the school isn't measuring up, it will be turned into a charter school.
And that's the public schools. Now, how about the voucher schools, the private schools that receive some funding via vouchers that pass through the families involved?
Right. So they, too, are going to be graded, although they may be graded by a different criteria, potentially. But private schools that accept voucher students, if they fail, they would have to stop taking voucher students for 4 years.
And now this came up last session. The idea of school accountability didn't end up passing by the end of the session. Are things expected to be different this time?
I don't have a crystal ball. During the last session, though, you know, some lawmakers felt like, you know, these penalties were too harsh. This issue of, you know, how do we punish essentially schools that don't measure up? Assembly Speaker Robin Voss suggested to reporters this week that things are different this time around. He says the makeup of the Assembly and Senate has changed, so much so that passing this kind of legislation or one incarnation of this legislation is really a possibility. Now, I don't think everybody's on the same page. You've talked with folks, lawmakers, who certainly may be on a different page.
Right.
But at least as far as Robin Voss is concerned, you know, he thinks the situation has changed.
Yeah, this could be a case we're hearing from a couple different observers on this issue where there are differences among Republicans in the legislature, but they're probably going to hammer those out and pass something. Have we heard from Governor Walker on this?
A little bit. The governor weighed in this week, and he basically told reporters that it's headed in the right direction, that it has some of the pieces that he's looking for in any kind of school accountability bill.
And the Democrats, a minority in both houses, but what are they saying?
Democrats called the plan essentially a giveaway or a gift to the backers of private schools, and they say they suggest that these are the same people who support Republicans during their campaigns.
All right. Well, from the schools now to the courts, some legislation on how we get a chief justice here of our state Supreme Court.
Right. So there's a proposed constitutional amendment that would essentially require members of the court to elect the chief justice. And the Assembly Judiciary Committee held that hearing on that amendment this week. Right now, the longest serving justice is automatically the chief.
That's Shirley Abramson right now. What are people saying about the motives behind this?
Right. So some court watchers say it's basically an attempt by conservatives to unseat the current chief, Shirley Abrahamson. She is considered a liberal. They also say that voting will sort of insert politics in what is basically an administrative function that requires a lot of experience on the court.
So what's the case for this?
Well, supporters of the change, and this includes former Supreme Court Justice John Wilcox, and he says it will actually lessen some of the bitter infighting that has taken place in the past few years. Wilcox argues that it will actually increase transparency and create space for new ideas if the court itself is in charge of voting for who becomes the Chief Justice.
And briefly, the Chief Justice you mentioned oversees other courts. Are we hearing from lower court justices?
Right. So, yeah, this is a position that oversees basically the state's court system. And, you know, circuit court judges have weighed in on the issue. A former state appeals court judge this week during the hearing said every circuit court judge should get a vote. Not just the members of the Supreme Court, but in fact, every circuit court judge.
This is a constitutional amendment, or would be. What's the timeline looking ahead?
Right. So both the Senate and Assembly have actually approved this bill. They approved it last session. So if it is approved this year, it will be on the April 7th ballot.
All right. Noah, thanks as always for keeping us up to date.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
That's Noah Ovshinsky, our Central Time news guy, official title, Assistant News Director at WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is back with me on Tuesday. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.